Okay, I guess I would welcome everyone to the first in another year's set of Lonergan Research Institute graduate seminars. Now, this is at least our 20th year of doing this, and it's proven to be enduring and helpful to people. And I think Bob Doran and I, who have been the co-organizers of the enterprise for its two decades, look forward to doing it again and profiting from supporting or helping people profit from their interactions with one another. I've circulated for your information a handout that has the schedule of seminars for this term. Typically we have two in the fall and three in the spring. I would also circulate a sign-up sheet, which gives you an opportunity to put down your email address and thereby be contacted forever and ever until you die or drop off email. Maybe that comes to the same thing with the information about seminars each term and each year. So I'll just start this and ask whoever ends up with it to get it back to me. And for our first seminar, as we've done in prior years, it's perhaps not inappropriate to take just a moment or two right at the very beginning and at least by name and institution introduce ourselves so we have some sense of who we are. My name is Michael Thurston, and I work at St. Michael's College.
I'm Bob Doran. I'm at the Lonergan Research Institute and at Regis College.
I'm Conrad, and I'm doing my last year at Regis and MTS.
I'm Mary Jo McDonald, and I just completed my MDiv and thinking about more studies with Regis.
Meg Lavin, I teach here at Regis.
Jean-Denis Felix, second year MDiv here at Regis.
I'm Jeff Allen, St. Mike's MA.
I'm Ravi Lewis, third year MDiv here at Regis.
I'm Bernard, doing THM here at Regis.
Okay. Avriel, formerly of St. Mike's, now of Boise UT. Okay.
Bob Corcoran at the Lonergan Research Institute.
Gilles Mongeau, I teach here at Regis.
Gerard Wormsley, teaching philosophy in South Africa.
Robin Koenig, PhD candidate at Regis.
Anand Delgata, I'm a student here at Regis.
I'm Danny Monster. I spend my days at the Lonergan Research Institute.
Some nights too.
Robin Crapper, I'm a lay student at MDiv student at St. Augustine's.
Sean Mulroney, I teach philosophy at St. Augustine's.
Leo Cerullo, I discovered yesterday I'm no longer, my student card was canceled yesterday. I no longer can do anything at the university, and today I defended my dissertation. And Al Lonergan's Theology of the Trinity.
Gabriel, I am second year MD for your college.
George Zurich, PhD at Regis.
Darren Diaz, PhD, St. Mike's.
And Reed Laughlin, I'm at St. Michael's, new faculty.
Greg Lozon, and I'm with the Lonergan Research Institute as well, where I spend both days and nights.
Most of the nights.
Gordon Rickson, Regis College.
Everybody self-identified now? The usual pattern here is old-timers will know. We've got a presentation that is usually commentary on the paper that has been available for the last week or so. That runs up to about 30 minutes max. Then there's a response of 7 or 8 minutes maximum, kind of mediate for the commentary discussion, which goes on until 5:45, at which time promptly we stop. Before I take the further step, I'll just, is there anyone here who came in later that needs a copy of the paper? Everyone's? Okay. Our presenter today is, just introduced himself, Robert Doran. Be talking about a paper that he's been working on in different venues, and I'll go on from there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for being here and taking the time to and the interest in this. The paper is part of a history, and I think I should probably trace a little bit of the history behind this particular paper. Not the long history, but the short history. A chapter in my own personal history. A chapter that begins with a seminar that Sean McGraw gave in March of 2003. On a paper which has he subsequently published in the Review of Metaphysics, entitled Heidegger and Duns Scotus on language, I don't remember, it's in a footnote here, but that's your material. Heidegger and Duns Scotus on truth and meaning, that's what it was. And that seminar ignited a series of questions in me that brought me back to my studies in 1972 and 1973 when the notion of psychic conversion occurred to me while I was reading Heidegger, while I was reading Heidegger's Kant and the Problem of Metaphysics. And it encouraged me to go back to those initial questions with respect to the relationship between Heidegger and Lonergan, which is an issue that has fascinated me ever since I took a seminar in the later Heidegger from Bill Richardson in 1968 at Fordham University. So that led to a paper which I delivered at the Lonergan Workshop at Boston College in 2003, entitled Reception and Elemental Meaning, an expansion of the notion of psychic conversion. That paper became the topic of a Regis faculty LRI seminar in January of 2004, and it will be published in the next issue of Toronto Journal of Theology. That's the start of what I'm doing here in this paper. Then there were three lectures that I gave in the spring, in April, May, and June, and this is the June one. In April, I went to the West Coast Methods Institute at Loyola Marymount University, and I gave a very abbreviated presentation of what was in that longer paper under the title, Empirical Consciousness in Insight, Is Our Conception Too Narrow? And I found evidence, at least I thought that I found evidence in Insight itself to support some of the materials that I had given in the paper on reception and elemental meaning. I'll come back to those issues, but I just want to trace these. And then in May, I did the same thing, a similar paper at Concordia University in Montreal, but there my interlocutor was not Heidegger or Wittgenstein, as was the case with the earlier paper, but rather Habermas. But it was the issue of language and insight and steps toward the resolution of a problem. And then this paper, Complicate the Structure, which I gave at Boston College Lonergan Workshop in June. The title for this paper came out of a conversation with Michael Verton at the West Coast Methods Institute when Michael informally said, well, what are you going to talk about? And I told him, and he said, that sounds like you're complicating the structure. So I said, yeah, okay. So that's the source of the title of this. But that clicked off something in my memory because I remembered something that Lonergan said about complicating the structure in his lectures in 1968 at Boston College. So, but the main point of this paper is a response to a dialogue that I had at Loyola Marymount with Patrick Byrne. Because in Pat's presentation at Loyola Marymount, he started to talk about the scale of values, vital, social, cultural, personal, religious. And he said, you know, I don't really know where Lonergan got that from. So in the question-answer session after his lecture in public, I said, it seems to me that the scale of values is isomorphic with the levels of consciousness. And Pat said he had some hesitation on affirming that, but I said it's always seemed obvious to me. And when I teach the scale of values, I'll teach it that way, and my students don't seem to have a problem with it. And Pat said, well, you know, I'm not so sure about that. So I took complicating the structure, and I said, you know what the scale of values is basically complicating the structure of experience, understanding, judgment, and decision. So that's what the main point of this paper is that the scale of values is a complication of the basic structure. That's the main point of it. But there's a lot of other things that come into it, as you know, if you had a chance to either read it or even browse it. So the phrase complicate the structure arose when Lonergan attempted to answer the question, this was in 1968 at Boston College, how does one get from transcendental method to the general categories in theology? And he said, there are five ways, and one of them was complicating the structure. And then he mentioned a number of other things that you can do. You can complicate the structure, you can turn to concrete instances of the structure, you can fill out the structure, you can differentiate the structure, you can set it in motion. The whole point being that the ground of the general categories in theology, the categories that theology shares with other disciplines, is the invariant movement of the operations of intentional consciousness. The shorthand for that being experience, understanding, judgment, and decision. So he's saying, well, how do you move from experience, understanding, judgment, and decision to these general categories in theology? Well, you can complicate that structure, you can turn to concrete instances of it, you can fill it out, you can differentiate it, you can set it in motion. And in the paper, I indicate how some of those, four of those, come over quite clearly into method and theology, but complicate the structure doesn't come over, at least in so many words, into method and theology, which is why I call it a forgotten precept, even though it's not forgotten in the sense that he's doing it in method and theology, but he just doesn't tell you that that's what he's doing. So complicating the basic structure of the operations is one of five ways of moving from the structure to the general categories, which of course are based in the structure. Okay. Lonergan gave four examples in 1968, in his lecture in 68, of complicating the structure. The treatment of common sense and insight, he said, is a complication of this basic structure. So he's presented a good part of the treatment of the structure in the chapters on science, and then he moves into common sense, and you've got all of a sudden you've got interferences coming in the sense of bias, you've got patterns of experience, so that it's not just experience, but the patterns of experience, and you've got the different kinds of bias, you've got the subject working in community, the relationship between the dialectic of the subject and the dialectic of community, and so on. All of that's a complication of this structure in those two chapters on common sense. The differentiation of the heuristic structures, classical, statistical, genetic, and dialectical, they're all complications of the structure. They're all matters of experiencing, understanding, judging, but they're different anticipations employing those same operations. The development of an integral heuristic structure in metaphysics, and then the most interesting one for certainly in the context of his lecture in 68 and also for my purposes here, the very notion of functional specialties. The notion of functional specialties is basically a complication of this basic structure of experiencing, understanding, judging, and deciding. Because the key is to bring the operations of all four levels of conscious intentionality to bear upon achieving the ends peculiar to each of the four levels. And so in research, you bring experience, understanding, judgment, and decision to bear on achieving the objective of experience, making the data available. In interpretation, there's a combination of experience, understanding, judgment, and deciding, all involved in achieving the end of the second level, understanding, interpreting a text, and so on. So with each of the functional specialties, all four levels are involved in achieving the end of one particular level. In different levels with different specialties. So this paper presents, or suggests at least, two further examples of complicating the structure. First of all, I briefly revisit the material that was covered in a lot greater detail in those other three papers, and especially the longer paper, which is at least as long as this one, Reception and Elemental Meaning. And here we have an instance of bringing, I think, we have a spontaneous, first of all, I'm suggesting in this first instance, a spontaneous complication that happens in everyday life. As we bring the four levels to bear upon the reception of meaningful data at the level of, I think, an expanded empirical consciousness, or at least that's what I'm suggesting in the paper Reception and Elemental Meaning. I'm mainly here trying to bring Lonergan, find a way to bring Lonergan into contact with the concerns in theology of von Balthasar, in the philosophy of Heidegger and Wittgenstein. As some of you have read that earlier paper, and you know that those are my concerns. So that's the first instance. The second instance, and the one that is mostly attended to in this paper, has to do with the scale of values in response to my dialogue with Pat Byrne. In the very pursuit of the scale of values, all four levels are brought to bear on achieving the multiple objectives of each of the four levels of consciousness. And so vital values, well, we don't just use experience to achieve vital values, we use all four levels, and changing the social order and so on and so forth. All four levels are brought to bear on achieving the objective of a given level. And in the in the reflective elaboration of the scale of values in a philosophy or a theology, we account for that multiple complication, and that's what I'm trying to do in that part of the paper. So the principal objective of the major part of this paper is to argue that the integral pursuit of the scale of values, whether it's done spontaneously or deliberately, is a complication of the basic structure of experiencing, understanding, judging, and deciding, and that this is the basis for the transcendental and transcultural validity of the scale of values itself. And in a sense, for my purposes, it better be, because I make a great deal of the scale of values as providing a central set of general categories in what I'm proposing as a theology of history, or trying to do systematics from the standpoint of history. If the scale of values is, in fact, not derived from the structure, then I'm in trouble, because Lonergan wants the general categories all to be based in the structure. But then I said, you know, I think it must be, because did he ever say anything that wasn't based in that structure? You know, that somehow it's got to come out of that. So, but it also, it's always seemed to me to be quite natural, to quite almost obvious, that there's an isomorphism between the levels of consciousness and the levels of value. And then at the end of the paper, I'm suggesting that at this point we have the beginnings of a set of categories for a doctrine and theology of social grace, and that we are possibly contributing to Lonergan's efforts in his great paper, Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, to articulate a basis for collective responsibility. So the second example is more important for this particular paper than the first. The first one was dealt with in detail, especially in the paper Reception and Elemental Meaning. However, let me speak briefly to the first complication, and then I'll expand more on the other one. The first complication, then, acknowledges the influence of so-called higher levels of consciousness on the first or empirical level. I started to argue after reflection on Sean McGraw's paper that there's something like an empirical givenness of intellectually structured meaning. and that this meaning functions effectively and constitutively in human life before it is subjected to critical examination and personal and communal appropriation or rejection. So in this paper, I say on page 10, with a sideways bow to Wittgenstein, I emphasize that received meaning in large part has the intelligibility of ordinary meaningfulness of public language. But in accord with the emphases of Lonergan, and so with a straightforward bow to him, I insist that it is also the product of the original meaningfulness of the insights, judgments, and decisions of those who have preceded us. There's an ordinary meaningfulness of publicly sedimented expression, as such expression mediates the reception of data, and there is an original meaningfulness of what proceeds by intellectual emanation when the subject raises his or her own questions for intelligence, reflection, and deliberation, answers these questions in acts of understanding and in judgments of fact and of value, and formulates the answers in inner and outer words that contribute to the communal fund of ordinary meaningfulness. The point of the earlier paper being that, by and large, Heidegger's Verstehen and Wittgenstein's emphasis on the public meaningfulness of language are dealing with ordinary meaningfulness, the ordinary meaningfulness of everyday living, and Lonergan's, by and large, spelling out the structure of original meaningfulness. Eventually, it is hoped that this sedimented set of meanings and values into which we are born will be subjected to the processes that culminate in our own original meaningfulness. But my emphasis in those three papers, but basically reception and elemental meaning, and summarized just a little bit here, has been on the expansion of the more or less standard notion or conception of empirical consciousness. I'm suggesting that we can expand that so as to include the reception of intellectually structured meaning and communally transmitted values. This theme is given a very brief statement in this paper, and further exploration of this would have to go especially to the paper reception and elemental meaning. But I suggested it first of all in the paper at Loyola Marymount and then here, that there are some bases in insight for this, and especially that structure of consciousness as it's laid out in the chapter on judgment, where on the level of presentations you have not only the things that we ordinarily put on that level, but also free images and utterances. This is on page 12 in the paper. This little diagram here is right out of chapter 9 of Insight. On the first level you have data, perceptual images, free images, utterances. And Lonergan says about this schema, then the second level, questions for intelligence, insights, formulations, the third level, questions for reflection, reflection, and judgment. The second level presupposes and complements the first. The third level presupposes and complements the second. That's second nature now to anybody that's read Lonergan. The exception lies in free images and utterances, which commonly are under the influence of the higher levels before they provide a basis for inquiry and reflection. But he's placed them on the first level, free images and utterances under the influence of the higher levels before they provide a basis for inquiry and reflection. And I'm saying that that's, by and large, not perhaps exclusively, this realm of ordinary meaningfulness, and that Heidegger's onto with Verstehen. His Verstehen is not Lonergan's insight as a release to the tension of inquiry. I don't find that in his talk of Verstehen. It's something else. It's an active intelligence, but it's not that. It isn't that the original insight giving rise to original meaningfulness. And that's also what Wittgenstein is onto with the public meaningfulness of ordinary language. So there's that source in insight that would more or less support what I'm trying to say. And then Danny pointed out to me yesterday the material on the vis cogitativa in Thomas and Lonergan's few remarks about that in Verbum, which I checked. And it does tie in. There is, a relationship here. At least I would suggest that it's worth exploring. All right. But the principal concern in this paper is rather with the scale of values, not with that. Lonergan does not tell us how he derived the ascending scale, vital, social, cultural, personal, religious. But I've always assumed that the scale is based on the increasing degree of self-transcendence to which one is carried in one's response to values, and that the levels of value are isomorphic with the levels of consciousness. So that vital values correspond to experience, particular goods, social to understanding, cultural to reflection and judgment, personal to deliberation and decision, and religious to God's gift of love. Patrick Byrne greeted this suggestion with some tentativeness, openness but tentativeness, and that's what drove me back to the drawing board here, for if that assumption is not correct, then a crucial set of general categories in the systematic theology that I'm attempting to write is called into question. My statement, page 14, surely it is true that vital values entail more than experience, that the social value of the good of order entails more than understanding, that cultural values entail more than reflection and judgment, and that personal value entails more than decision. But may it not be argued nonetheless that vital values have some correspondence to particular goods, which in Lonergan's scheme of the human good are always correlated with the level of experience, that social values have some correspondence to the good of order, which for Lonergan is always a function of understanding, that cultural values have some correspondence to judgment, and that personal values have some correspondence to the existential moment in which one discovers for oneself that it is up to oneself to decide just what one is going to make of oneself. Only the correspondence of cultural values with reflection and judgment raises questions, I believe, but I cite in the paper a number of references in Lonergan's work that would support this correlation. So my conclusion is presented on 17 and 18 on that particular question. So I think it can be argued that there is sufficient evidence in Lonergan's writings to support the position that the scale of values is a function of these structural invariants, and is indeed isomorphic with them, even as the pursuit and realization of any one of the levels of value, at least vital, social, cultural, and personal, entails bringing the intentional operations of all four levels to bear upon attaining the objective of one level. It can, in fact, be argued that we are here dealing precisely with a fresh apprehension of the structural invariants themselves, and it's in these fresh apprehensions of the structural invariants that Lonergan locates cultural development. Cultural development is a matter of the ongoing fresh apprehension, new apprehensions of the structural invariants. However, then I go on, section 6. This position remains static unless we add two more canons from Lonergan's 1968 lecture, namely identify concrete instances of this complicated structure and set the thing in motion. So section 6 of the paper is entitled Instances of the Complicated Structure in Motion. I begin with the statement in Natural Right and Historical Mindedness to the effect that the normative source of meaning in history is a tidal movement of self-transcendence that begins before consciousness, unfolds through sensitivity, intelligence, rational reflection, responsible deliberation, only to find its rest beyond all of these in love. The remainder of the paper argues four points. Number one, this statement demands a further complication of the basic structure, even when it's applied only to the authenticity of the subject. Number two, it supports another complication, namely the complication of the notion of dialectic. Number three, it can be employed also to complicate and fill out the structure of the scale of values. And number four, when this is done, the way is open both for a fuller account of the collective responsibility that was Lonergan's principal concern in Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, and perhaps for a new moment in the theology of grace, a theological grounding of the notion of social grace, or grace-filled social structures. We've talked about sinful social structures. Now we have perhaps the ground for talking about grace-filled social structures. So, number one, personal authenticity. Lonergan's statement that the normative source of meaning in history is this tidal movement that begins before consciousness, unfolds through the four levels only to find its rest in love, implies that we must grant that the symbolic operator, and he came to use this expression in philosophy and the religious phenomenon, the symbolic operator at the base of the structure, as well as the feelings that permeate the structure, and the topmost operator of interpersonal relations and total commitment, provide a needed complement to the operators of intellectual and moral development specified in Lonergan's intentionality analysis. The same subjective context is mentioned also in another paper, Mission and the Spirit, where his term is not tidal movement, but passionateness of being, and where it is insisted that the passionateness of being has a dimension of its own that enables it to underpin, accompany, and reach beyond the subject as experientially, intelligently, rationally, morally conscious. So putting those two quotations together, I argue that this dimension, distinct from but related to intelligent, rational, and moral operations, is released into appropriation by specifying a set of aesthetic dramatic operators, symbols, feelings, interpersonal relations, aesthetic dramatic operators, that mediate between the two dimensions, the symbolic operators that effect the transition from neural to psychic, unconscious to conscious, the affective operators that consist in our feelings that permeate all intentional operations, and the intersubjective operators that found community. Second, dialectic. This is a brief summary of pages 21 to 26 in one short paragraph. I revisit the notion of dialectic that I articulated in Theology and the Dialectics of History, arguing that the normative source of meaning in history itself has a dialectical structure. Dialectics of contraries are grounded in a tension, T-E-N-S-I-O-N, between intentional consciousness and this passionateness of being that has a dimension all its own. Intentionality and psyche in the individual constitute a dialectic of contraries that is to be affirmed, strengthened, and assumed as the foundation of one's conscious dramatic living. But there's also a dialectic of contradictories. We took all of this in class today. Either the solidary and creative tension of psyche and intentionality, or its dissolution by neglect of one pole or the other. This distinction is familiar to anyone who has followed my stuff over the past 15 years, but I'm raising it here in a new key, namely as a complication of the structure. Thirdly, the scale of values. And that begins on page 27. The dialectical structure of the normative source of meaning has at least three realizations in the subject, in culture, and in community. These are intimately interrelated while remaining distinct. There's a dialectic of the subject, censorship, and neural patterns. There's a dialectic of community, practical intelligence, and intersubjectivity. There's a dialectic of culture, cosmological, and anthropological. This increasingly more complicated structure is set in motion by specifying, setting it in motion now, getting it moving, by how these three are related to one another. The interrelations of the three processes can be understood by relating them to respective levels in the scale of values. The dialectic of the subject to the level of personal value, the dialectic of culture to the level of cultural values, of the dialectic of community to the level of social values, and by specifying the various interrelations among the levels in the scale from below and from above. So that, and that's the subject of most of theology and the dialectics of history, so I'm not going to try to repeat it here. Fourthly, collective responsibility and social grace, and this is the end. We're nearing the end of my presentation. The principal impetus for a theology of social grace, grace as a social reality, is actually provided by Lonergan himself in chapter 6 of De Deo Trino Pars Systematica. He's the only person that has ever, to my knowledge, defined the state of grace as a social and intersubjective reality. And that has been overlooked by just about every commentator on Lonergan. The state of grace is distinguished from the habit of grace. The state of grace is a social and intersubjective situation, where the subjects are the three divine subjects and a very widely inclusive community of human subjects, namely all who have said yes to God's offer of God's love. That's the state of grace and situation. Collective responsibility. We get closer to understanding what it is and to promoting it in the world if we understand that the normative source of meaning itself has these three instantiations, not just in the subject, but also in culture and in the community, in the social order. And if we can show how these three instantiations are related to one another. And that's what I try to do from page 26 all the way over to page 29, rather, all the way over to page 36, in much the same terms as in the book, Theology and the Dialectics of History. And then I conclude the paper with a theological point. If the scale of values is a complication of the basic structure, one that fills out the notion of collective responsibility that Lonergan grounded in that structure, then the relation of vital social, cultural, and personal values taken together to religious values must be isomorphic with the relation of experience, understanding, judgment, and decision taken together to grace, namely a relation of obediential potency. And this is what Danny gave us in his paper last year. And I quote Danny at this point in the paper, "But then if this is the case, we may also be on the verge of developing a doctrine of social grace corresponding to the recent development of the theological doctrine of social sin." And that doctrine of social grace would be by taking this the entire scale of the first four levels of the scale of values and placing them in obediential potency to the religious value that is the gift of God's love. So, here we are.
Thank you very much, Bob. Today, I happen to be the respondent. Robert Doran has written a paper that, for my part, I find wonderfully synthetic, clarifying, and refreshing. It provides astute explications of some important points from Lonergan, an excellent summary of one main thrust of Doran's own work, and some very stimulating suggestions about further developments that are required for the emergence of a theology of grace that would take adequate account of the communal dimensions of human living. To assist the transition from Bob's presentation to our own group discussion of this paper, let me offer a few comments of my own. Brief comments under four headings. First, my title here, an enthusiastic endorsement. It seems to me that Bob's basic claim about complicating the structure is right on target. Lonergan's four-level structure can be differentiated in several different directions, as it were, and getting clear on that fact can enhance one's appreciation of the structure's fundamental character in Lonergan's work and in one's own life. Moreover, Bob's own account of the structure of the scale of values, his second and more extended example of a structural complication, strikes me as both an excellent illustration of his general point and an admirably illuminating account in its own right. Second, I've got a puzzlement, which I'll express in terms of an illustration, or by reading an illustration. This is a little unease about what Bob pointed out. Is basically a peripheral example in this paper. It's the business about empirical consciousness potentially involving the givenness of intellectually structured meaning and communally transmitted values. I'm puzzled about how one would fit that into the Lonerganian framework, where, as I understand it, data is simply data as given. I can put the point positively, perhaps, my question, my puzzlement, in terms of an illustration and then a question. The illustration would consider or begin by considering a certain collection of written marks or spoken sounds. A natural scientist might ask about, thinking about that collection of written marks or spoken sounds, a natural scientist might ask about the features of the instrument that produced the marks, or about the interaction of lungs, tongue, and teeth that produced the sounds. A casual interpreter might identify the collection as a sentence, "Better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all," the expression of a contention familiar to most literate English-speaking adults. And that casual interpreter might go on to ask whether that contention is correct. A more penetrating and historically concerned interpreter might go still further, asking what, if anything, the expression, "better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all," asking what, if anything, that expression reveals about the inner life of its original author, William Shakespeare. Each of these three investigators experiences the same data, the written marks or spoken sounds. But successively richer discoveries emerge, precisely because of the progressively richer interests brought to bear on those same data. So my question then is, how is it that this three-way Lonerganian distinction, grounded not in empirical consciousness, but in intelligent, reasonable, and responsible consciousness, fails to do full justice to the Heideggerian and later Wittgensteinian claim that Bob rightly desires not be neglected by Lonerganians? Thirdly, some specific agreements that I'd like to underscore. I told Bob I spent the better part of last Saturday in the afternoon kind of smacking my lips and going over this paper with multicolored pens and so on. At the end, I felt I'd been through quite a workout, but also been marvelously illuminated. For specific affirmations, on page 17, toward the bottom, Bob says that he thinks it can be argued that there's sufficient evidence in Lonergan's writings to support the position that the scale of values is a function of these structural invariants, and indeed isomorphic with them, even as the pursuit and realization of any one of the levels of value entails bringing the intentional operations of all four levels to bear upon the objective of one level. As far as I'm in on this, and I'm partly in on it by virtue of my own effort to come to grips with it, apart from this paper, it seems to me right on target. On 22 through 24, just to kind of underscore a point that, at least as put this way, seems to me original with Bob, namely the sharp and very useful contrast between a dialectic of contraries and a dialectic of contradictories. Ever since I first heard the distinction put that way, I found it quite illuminating, and it seems to me that I would find it not only difficult to argue against myself, but it's not clear to me how a person who appreciates what the distinction is intended to cover could consistently argue against it. Thirdly, the overall enterprise, or the final cause, the ultimate goal toward which the paper is oriented, specifying the structure and continuation of collective responsibility in terms of a theory of social grace correlative with account developed by liberation theologians and others of social sin, it strikes me as thoroughly profound and probably the most exciting part of this paper for me to read, that being posed as the goal of it. And finally, in the same line, a particular illustration that I just kind of jumped up and down when I read on page 34. The work of God's grace in our contemporary situation includes this movement to interiorly differentiated consciousness as an agent of a world cultural network of alternative communities. Then he goes on to say, we must look to the dialogue of world religions as a principal arena for the cross-cultural generation of world cultural values. Religion, to be authentic, must be concerned not only with personal transformation, but also with cultural and social change, again, in accord with the scale of values, the structure of the scale of values, specifying dialogue of world religions as the context where responsibility for addressing this kind of thing in a corporate, communal, trans-religious way, or inter-religious way, again, I found quite illuminating and quite exciting. Next summer, I've committed to doing a summer course at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota, where I've been going every third summer for ever since the mid-80s, and about 3 months ago, I committed myself to doing a course entitled Christians Encounter Non-Christians. It's a 6 weeks MA course for persons in theology. And part of the big payoff of last Saturday afternoon is that it gave a lot of energy and some real richness that will find its way into that course. Finally, one specific question relates to passage on 19 and 20, it's just a little request for clarification. This is in the section entitled The Structure of Authenticity. Statement that I've quoted, 19, fear is a natural right and historical mindedness is the answer to a question. Because what is attained by the several principles that are operators of conscious intentionality are only aspects of something richer and fuller, must not the several principles themselves be but aspects of a deeper and more comprehensive principle? Lonergan's answer to that question is another question, and is not that deeper and more comprehensive principle itself a nature, at once a principle of movement and rest, a tidal movement that begins, that says beings, but I think he means begins, that begins before consciousness. Then a little later on that page, there's reference again to what in natural right and history is called a tidal movement. That is referred to rather as the passionateness of being. Passionateness of being has a dimension of its own that enables it to underpin, accompany, and reach beyond the subject as experientially, intelligently, rationally, and morally conscious. It's specifically so the question is this: when he talks about that underpinning, especially the underpinning as it antecedes or precedes experiential consciousness, in discussing the passionateness of being or the tidal movement in that way, is that kind of discussion something that unfolds within the frame of phenomenology, within the frame of Lonergan's first basic question, or is it not, as it seems to me it might be, an articulation of a point from within the framework of the third basic question, metaphysical talk? And so that's the question. If it is the latter, then the follow-up to the question would be what the linkage is between that kind of metaphysical talk and the phenomenology of consciousness that, as I understand it, is the context within which Lonergan gets at the structure that is so fundamental to Bob's faith. Thank you again.
Thank you. That's great. And that last question, I'll start with that. And I will just talk for a couple of minutes. And okay.
Greg told me we should. Yeah. Okay. He's got two, and then you're going to flip over your tape.
I'll just very briefly in response to that, and then I'll. I think it is unfolding metaphysical talk at that point. And the linkage would be, it seems to me, that in those later papers, Lonergan becomes increasingly open to saying that the structure of intentional consciousness itself is open on both ends. And that's the linkage, I think, that the openness of it on the lower end, or lower, if you want. I hate to use that because it sounds hierarchical, and I don't mean it that way at all. It sounds like it's lesser or whatever, and it isn't. I mean, it's just on the more basic level. Is the basis for that, I think, in terms of if you're going to ground everything in consciousness and in the phenomenology of consciousness, it would be in the openness of intentional consciousness on that level that you can talk about something preceding. So it's explicit in philosophy and the religious phenomenon, where he moves from talking quasi-operators, quasi-operators, to operators. He was reluctant to. I had spoke of symbolic operators in my dissertation, and he picked up on a lot of the stuff that was in Subject and Psyche, but he wanted to say quasi-operators, but in Philosophy and the Religious Phenomenon, which, admittedly, he never published. We found it after he died, but he switches to operators at both of those levels, symbolic operator and the topmost operator of intersubjective relations leading to community. Operating community. But yeah, it is metaphor. Okay.